Hello, welcome back to the New History Podcast. We're on episode 8. Today it's myself, Alex, as always, joined by Lily.
Hello.
And today our special guest is Dan Gosling.
Hello.
Hello. So you had a couple of things that you wanted to talk about today, and I suppose you'd best start with introducing yourself and the sort of topics that you'd like to go into.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Alex. I'm Dr. Dan Gosling, and I'm the early modern legal record specialist at the National Archives of United Kingdom. So I'm responsible for the legal collections for the period about 1450 to 1750, and sort of the legal records and everything that that entails.
Very nice.
And for the record, for everyone else to know, your background as a historian before you actually went into the National Archives, what did you study and what areas essentially took you to what you do now, or was it completely random? Did you just end up there by chance, or was there an actual purpose in what you study and working in the archives?
So I did my undergraduate in history and sort of focused on Roman history and Tudor history for undergrad. Oh. And then for my master's, I did medieval studies because there was a big gap in my knowledge there. I was always very interested in mm-hmm. it. And that when doing my master's, I sort of dipped my toe into legal history and realized that a lot of people are put off by it because the records can be very dry and they're always in Latin, very formulaic. So when I went to do my PhD at the University of Leeds, I did that on late medieval legal history, looking at the development of a specific statute all the way up to the English break with Rome in the 16th mm-hmm. century. So my background as a historian is sort of medieval to late medieval and early modern. But we're really a legal historian. While I was doing my PhD, I also worked at archives and worked in archives, both mm-hmm. as a researcher, but also working as a staff member at it was the Honourable Society of Gray's Inn, where I first worked in the archives there before going over to National Archives once I finished my PhD.
No, I think that's, when you said that you actually went into legal history because you realized most people were put off by it. I mean, I wouldn't lie. I was one of those people. I sincerely considered it, but I actually worked and I did a work placement at the Hampshire Record Office in Winchester. And I mean, I found it fascinating because you just find all sorts of random things in archives, particularly in local archives, where perhaps you don't expect to find these little gems. So it was really interesting. A lot of the work that I was actually doing with cataloging had more to do with more modern records things that people from the public just randomly donated. And simply because of how things are handed down, they tended to be, Victorian and sort of early 20th century type of stuff. Lots of things to do with like actual, properties, but houses, whatnot, deeds, that sort of things, and photographs. And I found the photographs fascinating because you just ended up sort of building this little story about who this person may have been or what their background was and whatnot. But when it actually came to just looking at proper documents, some of them could seriously be off-putting. So kudos to you for actually braving it and carrying it through to today. Yeah.
I wouldn't say it was intentional. Basically, my PhD was on a statute called the Statute of Primae Nerae, which I learned about from Tudor history actually at school. So when I was looking to do a master's dissertation, I said, oh, I remember this from school, but it's a medieval statute. What's it doing in the 16th century being used in the way it is? And then when I talked to people, they actually said, well, it's a bit too big for a master's thesis, but once you finish your master's, we'll have conversations. So we had conversations, but it sort of meant when I started my PhD, I had to learn sort of English law from scratch and learn the records from scratch. So it was a fun sort of 6 months to a year to really get your hand into that. And then once you get your eye in, it's fine. It's easy now, but
yeah.
I mean, it's good that you've mentioned about, actually learning English law, because I was going to ask, how much knowledge do you actually require of the legal system to be able to fully not just work with the documents and get a general idea from the documents, but to actually understand what the purpose of those documents were, what that says about the policies and the entire legal system of the time. Does it actually require a lot of full understanding of the legal environment of the period and the laws themselves as well?
Sometimes it does. I mean, it depends on what you're looking at. So I think having a knowledge of sort of why a record was created, definitely, no matter whether it's a legal record or just a different type of record, like a record created by the state, knowing why it's created and why it's arranged in the way it is really helpful. So if you're looking at a record of the Court of King's Bench, you know that's a case that's been brought into that court. And so knowing a little bit about that court and what sort of cases can be heard will really help you when you're looking at that record.
Yeah, of course.
But on the other side, knowing the courts is sort of one part of it, but knowing how a record is laid out is another part. Legal records are very formulaic. But modern legal records are quite formulaic as well. They're in a very set way. So once you've looked at a few of them and you sort of know the formula, they become a lot less intimidating. Because you know, if you're looking for certain names, for example, you know they're going to be in a certain place, dates, a certain place. If you want to actually find out what the case is about, you know it's going to be in a particular place because these legal records are so full. So they're very daunting to begin with, but once you sort of get your eye in, you start to learn the formula of it. It's not easy, but it does become easier in time.
Yeah, and with regards to languages, am I correct to believe that you said you had to sort of learn some Latin and some Old English to get, or Middle English to get your hands into that? And was that a knowledge you had already acquired through your study of history, or that you had to particularly develop for this purpose?
I learned Latin at school, but had forgotten all of it by the time I came to
Fair
actually use it
enough.
again when I was at university. For my master's in medieval studies, they taught Latin there, but it was Latin for medievalists, so it was showing us medieval records and how the Latin was used there, because obviously that's very different to classical Latin.
Indeed.
We didn't use too much Old or Middle English in the legal records, because I was dealing with the later medieval periods. By then, the English used is sort of closer to, English that we would see today. But there's also, when you're dealing with legal history, another language called Law French, or sometimes Norman French. And that's a
Oh, okay.
really weird thing. It's a language pretty much only spoken by English common lawyers. And it's the language that they spoke in and wrote their law reports in. It's similar to French, but not quite the same as French. And yes, yeah, so it's a very, very small pocket of people know how to use it.
What
And
sort
it's only
of
in use.
time period was that?
So it's only used by, I think it's about the 14th century. And we know that it ended in the mid 17th century because the lawyers basically went, "None of us know how to understand this anymore. Why are we still using this as a language?"
Fair
Because
enough.
it wasn't it was taught, but it wasn't really taught in the traditional way that the other languages were. It was a very shorthand way of writing in their reports and how they spoke. But the actual records of the court were in Latin. So predominantly the language that I'm working with when I'm working with legal records are in Latin. And then as you come into the early modern period, the language is English. So for the equity courts, those are all records in English.
No, that's good. I mean, I always sort of encourage people when they're studying history, any type of history, just learn some other form of language. It will be useful, even if you don't think so. But I think a lot of
Absolutely.
people underestimate how useful Latin still is. Even in, settings you perhaps don't expect it. It just doesn't have to be about antiquity or even early Middle Ages or religious documents, where obviously Latin was used extensively until way late into the Middle Ages. But this is a thing as well. And I know, for example, in Spain, this is also a tradition. Of course, well, it's a Latin language, so there is no big surprise there in Spanish. But even modern legal records these days and court hearings these days in Spain use words or specific sentences that are, taken as they were in Latin, and they've been carried out for, that purpose. So it is a very useful language to know in general.
Yeah, they're never
It
going to
is.
let it
It's really
die.
useful to know.
They said it's dead, but no,
Not
not
really.
such a thing. So on that front, and you've already talked about your background and whatnot. Can you tell us a bit more about what you actually do at the National Archives, and how does an everyday sort of routine go for you, or what overall do you do throughout your time there?
Yeah, of course. Cool. So in normal circumstances, so when we're actually on site and working in queue.
Yeah.
So the main sort of the general thing that I do is I make the legal collections at National Archives more accessible. And that's accessibility through just promoting the collections. Sometimes that's through Twitter, just me going, I found this really cool document or this really cool series that I don't think many people know about. But that also goes down to cataloging series. So if there isn't much description on the catalog, I sort of go back to the documents and see if we can put a bit more detail on there to open them up to people. And then I also give sort of public talks to academics, to the general public. Just really shining a light on the legal records at the National Archives.
Mm-hmm.
So how has the whole COVID situation affect what you normally would do, if you can tell us if that's had an impact or not?
So obviously there's no face-to-face inquiry service or anything like that. So we can't sort of advise people and people can't come into the archives. We can't go into the archives either. So there's no sort of physical cataloging on this series. But there are some series that there are finding aids kept at Kew in the map room where we managed to take images of them when we were allowed on site.
Nice.
And we've been using those to put data onto Discovery National Archives catalogue, which means that we can still do some cataloguing remotely, and we can obviously still promote the collections remotely from either research we'd done while the site was open or research we were still planning to do and we could do without having to use the documents themselves.
So I suspect with everything that's going on and obviously how this is affecting the access to the documents, the whole idea of digital archives and the digital humanities community must be obviously starting to pick up now, right? Because, well, if you can't be in the archive yourself, how are you supposed to conduct research? So no. I guess this is something worth revisiting as things move on. But it is good hearing it from someone who actually works with the records, because it must be so strange having access to all of these documents and suddenly they are completely off the limits. And, you know, it's a bit scary. I've been aware of several places in Europe and elsewhere that because of COVID and everything being locked away as well, some collections have actually been completely ruined because some form of incident has happened. Obviously, there was no one there to monitor it, and records have sadly been lost. And there's a recent case in Iceland, which actually was really harmful to us because it's access to some early, or some copies of some early medieval documents about the formation of Iceland and the Viking colonization. So I'm just, you know, wondering, is that something that it's now going to be part of your role, sort of moving forward, thinking how these records can be accessible in a digital way, not just because of a pandemic, but just in a general way so that people can carry on doing research moving forward? Or is that still something that you have to sort of rethink and you know, see how things go?
Yeah, well, in the archive sector, this has actually been a topic for a long, long time.
Yes.
COVID has sort of brought it into focus.
Mm-hmm.
That we've known for a long time that not everyone can get to archives. Not everyone can request record copying. And, you know, sometimes it requires quite in-depth research. So for a long time, archives and people in the archive sector have been thinking about how you can make records more accessible. But it's, you know, it's something you don't want to just throw a load of images up online. You want there to be some sort of order to it. And you've just sort of got to think what people want the most, and everyone wants something different, and how much time and resources to get those ones available. So it's always been a question about where the priorities lie. Also thinking about collection care and preservation of documents. Which documents would it be better to make copies of now,
right,
so that they are used less? So it's always been on the mind of people that work in the archive sector for a long, long time. But particularly now during COVID, I think those questions are being brought to the fore again. But the same sort of questions and problems are coming up. It's what do you prioritize?
Yes.
Why do you prioritize it? Who is it for? And so, I mean, people in the archive sector do what we can. But it's just answering those questions, prioritizing what goes online And while we can't access the archives, it's how can we sort of open up those collections without being able to physically show the document? So, you know, what we've been doing, well, what I've been doing in the last year is sort of improving the catalogue where I can, or talking about records I know, just saying once the archives open up again, there's this incredible collection. Please go and use them.
I suppose a lot of people will probably think, you know, it's just a matter of a decision to digitize everything and then put it online, but there's so much of it that it just takes years, doesn't it? I suppose. So even
I
with
mean,
the coronavirus, you can't just suddenly decide to make it accessible.
even the smallest repositories and record collections, you know, the time and resources required to digitize everything and then think about hosting that online, where you host it, how people can access the documents, where they can download them. That's just a huge enterprise. And then when you get to the larger collection, national collection of hundreds of thousands of records, maybe millions of records, you just where you do the time and resources to digitize everything is just not there. It would take hundreds of years.
And I was going to say that, you know, it's also difficult making those decisions, what documents or what collections are more worthy or more important to be online than, you know, offline and whatnot. So it's not as simple as people just want it to be, like, oh, you have the record, you know, just scan it or whatever and put it on the internet. And, you know, some records can't actually just be scanned by in normal ways. They need special machinery. These machineries are not abundantly available, and it just takes time. So it's not as simple as some people really want it to be. But anyway, I'm glad that things are actually moving forward. And if there is some silver linings to take from COVID, I guess, you know, this becoming a more important and sort of key aspect of how these collections are moving forward, it should be a good thing, I hope, anyway. But there you go. So,
Yeah, I think it's made everyone think more about it and see what we can.
yeah, putting things in perspective. So we can always learn from things, historians at least, or we will try,
We'll
certainly.
try to.
So on that front, I actually wanted to move the conversation now to what you've been researching and that I think is fascinating, which is bear gardens. And yes, people, you've heard correctly. It's bear, not beer gardens, which is what I thought originally. So Dan, could you tell us what is a bear garden and why did you come across this, and you know what it's
Why does it
actually?
exist?
Why bear garden?
Okay, so the what's relatively so the Bear Garden was a site in Elizabethan and Jacobean, so 16th, 17th century Southwark, just sort of south of the River Thames, which is now sort of considered part of London, but then was in Surrey. And it was where bears and other sort of exotic animals were kept for bear baiting in the arena. So it was very close to where Shakespeare's Globe was, the original Globe Theatre, and the Hope Playhouse and the other sort of playhouses, theatre district in Southwark. So it was a garden where the bears stayed, basically. And the why, how I ended up researching that, it's not something I ever thought I'd be researching. But part of my job, as I said, at National Archives is to catalogue and list series that haven't got any descriptions on Discovery. And I was going through some of these large finding aids that are in the map room at Kew for a record series called C146, which is an ancient deeds series. The deeds listed land transactions and sort of office transactions between private parties and also the Crown. And we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of those at National Archives. But when listing one of those, I came across one that was a lease of a garden in Southwark. And at the end, it said that there was a bear schedule. And I read it and thought it was a typo, because it's an odd thing to read when you've been reading hundreds of these sort of very quite dry land transactions. So I ordered up the document to see what it was. And lo and behold, there was this schedule which listed all the bears, bulls, horses, apes in this garden. And the reason they were listed was because at the end of the 7-year lease, the person that was paying for the land had to give the garden back with all those animals or pay the values of the animals given. So you get a list of bears called, I think there's Old Nan the She Bear, and there's a bear called Harry of Warwick, and they've all got these sort of very Shakespearean names. So that I found that really interesting, just that one document on its own. But I couldn't sort of let it lie, and I wanted to dig a little deeper. So the reason that the National Archives holds deeds like that is usually because they came in as exhibits in court cases. Okay. So we wouldn't usually keep those sort of deeds of ownership because they're not anything to do with the government or the crown. So a deed that you hold on to if you hold a piece of land. So the only reason it would come in to the crown is if it's, or into the government records, is if it's coming as part of a court case. So say you're coming into the Court of Chancery and you're disputing a piece of land, then you turn up with your deed of ownership, or sometimes, you know, a century's worth of deeds relating to this one place to go, yes, you know, I lawfully have this piece of land. So these hundreds of thousands of deeds we have at the National Archives sometimes can be connected to court records that we also have at the National Archives. So I thought I'd do a little digging and see what I could do with this one deed relating to a bear garden. So the first thing I did, I looked through the rest of that deed series and did find about 2-3 dozen deeds all relating to, it didn't specifically say the bear garden in Southwark, but it was saying a garden in Southwark, south of the Thames, and you could tell from the description it's the same place. And this is going back centuries to sort of, I think the earliest one I found was Henry VI's reign. So yeah, you're going back sort of 200-300 years. And they're all related to this same place. Another reason I knew they're all related to the same place because they'd all been signed on the back by, and you can make out the capital letter E and then the surname Allen or Elaine. We're lucky that Edward Allen is quite a well-known actor and then theatre owner from the 17th century who has a very well-catalogued archive at Dulwich. So I was able to find records with his signature and go, yes, that's his signature. That's brilliant. So we know that at some point all these deeds are now in the National Archives collection were owned by this one man at this time. And these are deeds that go back 3 centuries. So, you know, it's a 17th century theatre owner that's owning a deed from the 15th century.
I mean, that's fascinating how you know, out of something that just seemed like a typo. And I wonder how many people would have previously or you know, overall just disregarded as, oh, someone clearly just wrote this funny. And but you actually took the time and went into it and found out this whole thing, which had been happening for, you know, hundreds of years, just casually, without no one knowing. I just think it's fascinating. And it really shows how interesting and not dry legal history and archive work can be, right?
Don't get me wrong, legal history can be very dry. You can get good stuff out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just interesting. And as well, you know, how you've explained the process, it's very different of how we would normally do the work as historians. Because you almost work backwards, like, but also in a lateral way. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, so obviously when I did my PhD, you go into it with an argument or some sort of hypothesis, and then you go to the archives, or you go to the archives to find the original records that support that hypothesis and argument, which is how most of us as historians think. But working in archives now, it's sort of I found the record and then went, so what does this record mean, and sort of came up with the question from the existence of the records. So you're sort of doing it in the opposite way. But I mean, I really enjoyed it. It's really fun digging down into the records and sort of going, well, if this one deed is here, then surely other ones are. And then when you find those other ones, it's fantastic. And when you find these other ones with the same signature on the back from 200 years before, you're like, this is amazing.
Yeah, no, it's cool. And I don't think it's necessarily what most people expect that archive work is like, which is, you know, it's peculiar in its own way. So hearing it from you, it's good, because I always thought that I've almost always done research that way, and I thought it was just me. But then when I ended up at the archives, I realized actually no, this is how many people do their research. Not actually thinking, oh, this is what I'm going to try to prove and try and find the evidence, but actually picking something and thinking, okay, what is here? What is the value of this? And what can I find from this? And what does this actually mean?
Guess rather it's just than pulling a thread, really, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
Absolutely, and yeah.
It's strange because sometimes it can be a bit daunting because you just have this something that seems very minute, and that surely there couldn't be a whole research to, you know, come from it. But most of the time, like you said, you know, if it happened once and you have a record of it, it's unlikely that it was, you know, in isolation. And if it was in isolation, well, that's worth investigating on its own right, because that must have been so special or peculiar for it to actually have come down to us in history, that we have that one-off weird thing that happened, and we can try and understand it now and preserve it, obviously. But I think it's fascinating. So could you tell us overall, what have you actually learned about Elizabethan and Jacobean society or the legal courts based on these records that perhaps you didn't expect, or that really helps you understand the, I don't know if need is the right word for these venues of bear gardens, but the existence of these bear gardens overall? Because when I was, you know, reading about it and thinking about it, you know, where I come from in Spain, it's not the same, but obviously we have a bullfighting culture, and there were venues and have been venues for this as far back as pretty much, you know, from what you're saying, what bear gardens have been. And it's a very similar type of thing, but with bulls. You know, you keep the bulls, you have all of this land, you work the land, the bull reaches a certain age, then you put it for show, and then it becomes sport, which obviously is controversial, at least nowadays. But, you know, back then, there was a reason for it. It was, at least in the case of bullfighting, and it still happens in Spain, it was for the sake of entertainment, and it was seen as a way of kind of like gladiatorial games, you know, getting people entertained, but also keeping their minds away from all of the political fuss that was happening around that time or in relation to the game. So have you found anything like this happening with Bear Garden, or is it just a completely different thing with its own reasons and
well, no, that sounds very similar to what I found. So it's very much seen as similar to theatres and plays. And right. In fact, the bear garden, the site of the bear garden was actually sort of torn down and built upon, and they built the Hope Playhouse, one of the great sort of Jacobean playhouses. And in the research at Dulwich Archives, well, from the digitized collection of Dulwich Archives, because it's all available online, which is fantastic, the Henslow Henslow Allen collection is all available online, digitized, which is incredibly useful, particularly now. But from that, they've got an agreement between the people that built the Hope Playhouse and the carpenter. And they describe that the stage was designed to be removable so that you could have bear baiting on certain days and then you could have plays on other days. So they wanted it specifically built so it could be both a venue for theatres and for bear baiting. So it's a form of entertainment. There were laws prohibiting those events on certain days, so this was a good way to get around that. It meant you could get money most days.
That's really interesting. It's that little loop in the law, literally. That's fascinating. Yeah. Is so there any reason why that was a thing? Like, why no bear baiting on, I don't know, whatever days it was, like Saturday, Sunday, or something like that? Or it was just purely arbitrary? Surely there must have been a reason.
I mean, I don't really know for sure, and I'm sure there are experts out there that do. I know that certainly even this time, bear baiting was seen as quite brutal.
Okay, so there was that perception already.
Too much. I think there was a certain perception, probably almost certainly not what we'd think of today, but they did see it as sort of barbaric sport and things like that. So I'm sure that came into play. But as I said, I'm not an expert on that topic.
No, but it's interesting that, you know, they already perceive that as, you know, brutal, violent, and maybe not for everyday taste. It's peculiar, because you would think, particularly, I mean, obviously, you know, at this time, England is going through different religious reforms and whatnot. But, you know, with Catholics and Protestants coming and going, I would have thought, at least judging from other examples, that if it was so controversial, there would have been something a lot more to say about it. But it's interesting. That's quite cool. But
have you been able to follow through on any records on this site, like, you know, further on into history as the place eventually becomes maybe less popular or shuts down as bear baiting, I think, eventually does become illegal in the 19th century.
Yeah. So the site got torn down or destroyed in the middle of the 17th century.
Okay.
During the sort of Civil War period, interregnum period. And there was another bear garden rebuilt in Charles II's reign in a similar area. The area does now have, I think it's Historic England status. So if you go onto their website, it's like a heritage status, and you can see where the original site was, where they've done archaeological work, and they found the foundations of the playhouse, which was built upon the old bear garden. So sort of the heyday of this particular bear garden and the surrounding theatres was the first half of the 17th century.
Okay.
That's interesting that then they took it down just to rebuild another one later on.
Yeah.
Well, I guess this is how things go. No, that's really, fascinating. It just baffles me how these things happen. But you also said that this was a venue where they kept some form of other exotic animals. So it wasn't just about the bears, I take it. Were there other animals, and were they also used for sport, or was it more like a zoo or like a farm type of facility, or were they just purely there for the bears?
I think they were all there for the sport. We know of some sort of adverts for these matches where it would be one bear, six dogs, something like that.
Okay.
From the bear schedule, we know that in that one bear garden there were bears, there were bulls, it was a red bull, there wasn't a single ape and a horse.
Well, yeah.
The ape and the horse didn't get a name.
Just,
oh, that's a shame.
Just anonymous. There you go.
I wonder what kind of ape.
I would be intrigued to know what that was. But do we also have any record of where these bears came from? Or, I mean, I don't know if they were like local or if there was some form of trade or if they were actively hunted for this purpose. Is there anything that you can find on the records that suggests this? Or is there the sourcing of these animals for sport kind of not quite known yet?
Not from the legal records I've been working with, but I did read, there's a really good article, which I forget the name of right now, about James the First actually had white bears, so
right.
Think of as polar bears, and it's a really good article. It's about where those bears would have come from.
It's interesting because, you know, just thinking about that, I would have expected, but then again, you know, history and the records don't always work the way we want them to, that if you have something like that, you know, sourcing white bears from somewhere, there must be a trade or some form of network, or, you know, somewhere from you would get them. But yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, animal trade has happened for hundreds and thousands of years, and not all of it was entirely legal. But no, I thought maybe you may have found some form of random dispute over the ownership of, I don't know, a bear or something like that. But I guess...
Yeah, so the disputes I've been looking at have really been over the land itself.
The land, more than anything.
And those have been really interesting. They've pretty much all been about Edward Allen, this theatre owner, who seems horrible, really.
Okay. So what type of things come up in these disputes? Is it like things like rent or venue use, or are there more personal things involved there?
So by and large, it's who owns those lands and those buildings so they can collect the rents from them. So the main case that Edward Allen seems to be involved in, I think I mentioned earlier, the Allen collection at Dulwich College is called the Henslow Allen Collection. Mm-hmm. Because the other great sort of theatre owner, Philip Henslow, was the father-in-law of Edward Allen, and they sort of co-owned several spaces. When he died, in his will, he allegedly left the site of the Bear Garden to some people, and Edward Allen sort of ends up getting a stake in that. And there's a decade or so of disputes, just under a decade of disputes, relating to Henslowe's will and who actually got the specific lands. So a lot of the court cases which I found, which are the most likely reason that we have those deeds in the Bear Schedule archives, are related to the Bear Garden, but also to the Hope Playhouse built on it.
Right.
So the initial Chancery cases are Henslowe's heirs, who are also called Henslowe, versus Edward Allen, saying, the Henslowe heirs are saying that the Bear Garden should rightly be theirs, and in Philip Henslowe's will it says they should go to them. And Edward Allen is saying no, because he said something to me on deathbed, and basically they're in dispute about which will is the correct will and who have those lands. And then Edward Allen sort of escalates that, and there's an Exchequer case, and at this time Exchequer cases were only really brought if it dealt with crown lands or crown money.
Right.
So what it looks like what Edward Allen had done was gone to the Attorney General and said that when Henslowe built, Philip Henslowe built the Hope Playhouse, the Hope Playhouse and the Bear Garden were originally on the lands owned by the Bishop of Winchester.
Oh, but of course.
Edward Allen argued that when the Hope Playhouse was built, they encroached on the Crown land just to the west of that.
Oh,
and built up on that. So Edward Allen went, because it's encroached on Crown lands, they've been taking money from this site, and some of that money should go to the Crown. And therefore he brings this Exchequer case. And the whole thing about the Exchequer case is arguing whether or not they encroached on Crown land. And it seems like it didn't. The Bishop of Winchester gives a really good response, because anyone sort of named in that has to respond and give an answer to the original. So the initial answer is from the two men that were meant to encroach upon the lands. But then they say, no, this is the Bishop of Winchester's lands. So they have to go to the Bishop of Winchester and go, are these lands yours? And his answer is really short. He goes, these lands are mine. Everything else relating to the dispute is unrelated to me. So don't bother me again, basically.
Excellent. I mean, it's that like, doesn't nothing surprise to do with me.
And then from those records, we find out really interesting things, like when they went to get witness statements for both the prosecution and the defence, Edward Allen sort of personally paid to get witnesses to the Exchequer to take witness statements, which is another thing that I found when I was looking through the Henslowe Allen collection online, because they've got Allen's diaries where he sort of gives costs on certain days. So in the court record, I'd found mention that they took witness statements on a certain day. I went to Allen's diaries and it says on this certain day, and it names two of the witnesses that we've got records for their sort of witness statement. So that was really cool, finding that sort of cross archive collection.
What sort of, like, what were the witness statements for in this case? Just to confirm who owned the land, or was it for
There are all sorts of things. So the first question is generally, do you know the parties involved? So do you know Philip Henslowe? Did you know Philip Henslowe, you know, Robert Allen, all those? And then it's like, do you know of the site called the Bear Garden? Do you remember when the Bear Garden rebuilt as the Hope Playhouse? Whereabouts was it? Did it encroach upon the certain lands? And it's those sort of questions. So it really is asking those questions to try to get to the truth of that.
I'd never thought they would use witness for that type of stuff, but that's...
Yeah, and it's really interesting.
That makes perfect sense.
You see, you find out little things. So the Bear Garden is literally where the bears are kept when they're not in the bear baiting arena.
Yeah.
But there's also a sort of small ditch with sort of a stream running through it, which they use to wash the bears. And we only know about that from these witness statements, because someone says, oh yes, the Bear Garden was here, and the stream next to it, that's where they used to wash the animals.
So some of these fine details actually come from some of those sort of more isolated accounts.
Some very dry legal records, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
I mean, I suppose it's good that someone's digging through it.
Yeah. But on that front as well, at what stage of the research do you think you are? Are you kind of done? Do you think there is more to find from these sources and our understanding of bear gardens? Or do you think you've kind of reached as much as you? Because it's difficult sometimes to ascertain how much can a source give, right? So how do you feel about this specific topic?
Where do you stop pulling the thread?
Yeah, exactly.
For me, I think I'm nearly there. My sort of argument that I came about was, why are the deeds in our collection? And then when I found out they were all owned by a certain person, how did they all come into the collection? What disputes were relating to that? So it's about this particular amount of deed ownership, this particular dispute, and this particular area of land. So I think for me, the research is nearly there. There's a huge amount more to learn about bear baiting and the site. And there's a lot of really good research being done about that at the moment. There's a couple of collections at the National Archives that I know about that are unlisted. Mm-hmm. And there could very well be more deeds and records relating to this topic. But it's, do I wait until I can get back and look into the dive into these boxes on the off chance that they're there? Or do I write up what I've got? I mean, chances are I probably will wait, because once you start pulling a thread, it's really difficult to stop. Yes. And you just want to know for sure that it's not in there. So I think I'm very nearly there, and I can certainly write up about 80 to 90% of it, but it's just those two or three series where I'm like, there could be records in here and it could be great, that's stopping me from fully writing it up. But no, it's been really interesting doing it, really good exercise, and sort of connecting court cases with deeds and just connecting everything together.
Mm. No, I mean, it sounds great. And I think I would feel exactly the same way that you, after finding this very random thing and actually being so exciting, I would be so worried that I would leave this few other archives completely overlooked, and then there is where this huge golden nugget is, and you just missed it because you know, you just thought, okay, that's enough of that, or whatever reason. It's fascinating, and at the same time it's making me anxious, because I want to go there and find out, is there more to this? No, I mean, it's,
well, I do think the one takeaway is, when you're doing research in whatever capacity, never just look at the one thing you're looking for. If you're looking at a particular reference, have a look through the volume you've got out, have a look for more folios or membranes, because even if you find something that's not related to your current research, you might find something interesting. You can dig into
it. Sorry to go on a tangent sometimes.
Oh, definitely. As long as you haven't got too many deadlines.
Yeah,
this is true. I'm becoming conscious of the fact that the time is starting to approach. So I guess before we go, and you know, learning this experience from the Bear Gardens and your experience with archives and archival work, which one do you think is the most underrated source that is perhaps, you know, easily available? You know, it's there, but people are just not going to it for information, whether because it's intimidating or because people just simply don't know about it, or just overlook it thinking it's far too obvious. Have you got anything in mind that maybe fits that criteria, and that you think, not necessarily you, but someone out there looking for, you know, a field or something to focus on, or just pulling the thread like you did with the Bear Garden, could potentially be a good thing to do?
I mean, I think the main thing is, it's a very general point, is that legal records aren't just for legal historians.
Yeah.
And I mean, I never started off as a legal historian. I do the occasional bit of legal history now and then, but I do use an awful lot of legal records in my research, and there's a lot in there for people. So don't be put off by legal records. Have a look at them. If you don't understand it, sort of ask someone for advice. But there's a lot of good stuff in there, not just for legal historians.
I mean, it makes sense. The law covers everything pretty much. So,
You
can find all sorts of details in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. It covers everything from local history to social history. You know, you see sort of sole female plaintiffs acting on their own in their cases in legal records, which their voices you ordinarily wouldn't be heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And within the legal records, do you think there is one specifically that are a bit more sort of ignored? Or because I know, you know, certain records from a legal point of view, particularly anything that has an interaction with the crown, I know a lot of like royal study type of historians and whatnot are more used to, but there must be others that perhaps are not so, you know, not sure if neglected is the right word, but, you know, things that other people just simply overlook because it's a legal record, therefore, ugh.
there's one thing I've found from sort of doing both medieval and early modern history is that in the medieval period, the common law records, so the records of King's Bench and Common Pleas, are used a lot, but that's because the language is in Latin. Mm-hmm. When you get to the early modern period, the language stays in Latin, but obviously so many other sources are in English that far fewer people use them. So I think that's a real rich vein of research, just because early modernists who might not necessarily have Latin, or they see records that are more easily accessible in terms of the language used, they would be put off by using them. And I think that, sort of looking at the common law records of the early modern period, there's so much good stuff there that, you know, similar to the stuff you're getting in the medieval period, but it's just used less because there are more records, or printed, or more widely available.
And just for the people at home who don't necessarily know what are these records about, could you summarize briefly what these common law records can involve?
Yeah, of course. So the common law records are the records of King's Bench and Common Pleas, and they are the law in England and Wales in the medieval period and early modern period. And I'm really struggling to define it right now. I'll just try to think of a good way to do it. They're the main legal record of the central courts in England and Wales. I'll go with that, I think.
Yep.
Do you mind re-asking the question or just rewording
fine. We'll do that again. So how would you define overall for the people, you know, sitting at home and that are not necessarily familiar with these records, or just lazy historians like myself who wouldn't necessarily want to go nearby them? What are these common law records about, or how do you define them as?
So the common law records, the common law is sort of the main law in England and Wales from the medieval period all the way up to the present day. The language of those records are in Latin. Other sorts of law come up, like the law of equity, which is the Chancery records, Court of Star Chamber, which you might have heard of as well. They're equity records and they're in English. Equity sort of existed to answer those grey areas. It was a bit more moral judgments. The common law was very much, did this person commit this offence or this crime? And it was a yes or no answer. And if they did, then they were guilty. If they didn't, so it's very much guilty or not guilty. Whereas an equity court was, to what extent did they commit this? What should their punishment be? And there was a lot sort of more, they can answer those grey area questions. Like they are guilty, a little bit guilty. So the common law is the main law in England. And those records are the main collection of records for the medieval period.
Brilliant. I mean, that seems a very good summary of what they are, and it's very clear.
I think so.
And now I feel bad that I never bothered looking at them, because I'm sure, you know, all sorts of random interesting stuff are recorded there. But, you know, it's I wouldn't have thought of it just simply for the thought of, oh my god, legal history, legal records, what am I going to do? So, you know, for those of you out there who may be in the same situation as me, and maybe threatened by this idea of legal records, look what Dan just found by looking at legal records. He just went and found about these bear gardens and everything else that come with it, you know, the entertainment industry of Elizabethan times and Jacobean times, and what people used to argue about money for, which was essentially land with bears, which is great. So yeah, don't underestimate these type of sources, because there could be something genuinely special, unique, and completely forgotten about that could genuinely be your jam, and the world, you know, deserves to know about it. But yeah, thank you very much, Dan, for explaining to us what bear gardens are and how you came to know about them, and, you know, really putting a positive voice out there for legal history and legal records and traditional archive work, because I know it's not necessarily the most popular aspect of history, but it's very valuable, like you've shown. So thank you very much for that. So yeah, unless you would like to say anything else before we go, that's all we have time for today.
That's it from me.
Brilliant. Excellent. No, we're good. In which case, thank you very much, Dan, again, for coming and talk to us about your research, the archives and Bear Gardens. And thanks, Alex, for hosting as always.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.